Good afternoon. I'm Greg Daniel, fellow managing director at the Engelberg Center here at Brookings. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us for our continuing series of roundtable discussions on medical product surveillance. We're very pleased to be hosting today's roundtable webinar that will highlight some of the recent findings from a mini-Sentinel medical product assessment. As part of mini-Sentinel's ongoing surveillance activities, investigators have recently completed an assessment that examined possible associations between the use of antihypertensive medications and angioedema events. This was a protocol-based assessment that compared the incidence of angioedema with drugs that target the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, and it used beta blockers as the comparators. While this assessment was not intended to provide a definitive conclusion on the association, the results have helped to interpret the larger context of what is known about drugs, and these drugs specifically from various sources. The assessment provides a great real example of how the Sentinel system is being used, and it also enabled many Sentinel investigators to build general strategies to assess suspected associations of selected medical products and possible adverse events. Today's webinar will begin with a brief description of FDA's rationale for developing this medical product assessment, and then we'll hear highlights from the findings from the assessment itself. Before we begin today's webinar, I'd like to go over just a few housekeeping items. As always, we encourage you to submit questions through today's presentation. The way that you can submit those questions is via online at the Q&A tab on the top of your screen, and you can go ahead and submit those as you think of them. Just as a reminder, please make sure that the microphone on your telephone is muted, and you can do that by either using the mute button on your phone or pressing star 6. However, in order to speak, please make sure to unmute and or press star 7 to unmute your line. And again, if you're experiencing any technical difficulties, please call the Level 3 conferencing number at 888-447-1119. So those folks can help you with any technical problems that you might be having. So today's presentations will come from first Marcia Reitman, who's Senior Advisor and Scientific Lead for Surveillance Programs in the Office of Surveillance and Epidemiology at the FDA. And then following Marcia will be Darren Toe, who is Assistant Professor at the Harvard Medical School and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute, and also Deputy Director of Scientific Operations of mini-Sentinel. We'll go ahead and have both of those presentations, and then after the presentations, we'll open up the lines for questions. Again, if you have any questions, please submit those through the Q&A tab on the webinar screen. And after those presentations, we'll also turn to you on the line for you to go ahead and read your question. And at this point, I'll go ahead and hand things over to our presenters, Marcia and Darren. Marcia, are you on the line?
I believe so.
Okay, great.
Okay, all right. So I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about FDA's rationale in initiating the angioedema assessment that you'll hear about today and in initiating other assessments as well. This assessment was one of the first protocol-based assessments to be started in mini-Sentinel and the first to be completed. As is aptly described in the editorial that accompanies the publication of this assessment, using mini-Sentinel in the way it was done for this assessment provides FDA with the opportunity to compare adverse event information during real-world exposure to drugs between various drug classes that have a similar indication within the ARB class of drugs where there were labeling variations, and that was one of the reasons for starting the assessment, and also to get information for the first drug in a new class of agents. Without this mechanism of using mini-Sentinel, it would have been very hard to find an environment where all these comparisons could be made. And as the results that Darren will present will show, the size of the mini-Sentinel database is really crucial to being able to assess these questions and get statistically meaningful results. Using mini-Sentinel also allowed us to obtain information from a data source that's largely independent of the potential for differential reporting of adverse events to FDA, especially with classes of drugs like these where the approvals span many years. There can both be different types of biases and also secular trends in spontaneous reporting that are not present when we use mini-Sentinel. Lastly, I wanted to mention that this assessment was conducted in a very efficient manner, both in terms of time and resources. And one of the fundamental reasons for this is that this assessment was built on a previously developed mini-sentinel infrastructure. That includes the mini-sentinel common data model, which is present at all data partner sites. And this allows a single SAS program developed by the mini-sentinel operations center to be applied to data at all the data partners at their own individual sites, and it eliminates the need for the creation of a new database structure for each of the protocol-based assessments that are performed. Thank you very much. That's basically the information I wanted to discuss.
Great. Thanks, Marcia. We'll go ahead and turn directly to Darren. Darren, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Okay? Take it away.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Marcia. So I'm presenting this on behalf of the work group. So the project was a collaboration among many FDA investigators across different offices and several mini-sentinel investigators from institutions. So here's the list of the workgroup members. So this is an overview of my presentation today. I'll start with background. So as many of you have already known, the mini-sentinel program is part of the Sentinel Initiative, and the program right now has over 30 partner organizations, and these are our partners in the program. So mini-sentinel is a five-year pilot. As Marcia mentioned, we have created a distributed data system that includes 17 data partners. In total, these data partners bring access to data for more than 125 million individuals with about 355 million person years of follow-up as of December 2011. So the distributed data system means that the data actually sits behind the firewall of each data partners. And for all the assessments that we are doing right now in mini-sentinel, only information that is needed for a particular analysis will be shared from a given data partner site to the coordinating center. And for all the medical product assessment that we are doing now, we only share aggregate information. So right now, we are not sharing individual level information for our medical product assessment. I'm going to explain to you how we do that using the NGOEDMA. So there are two overarching goals for this project. The first one is pretty straightforward. We wanted to look at the association between selected medical product and angioedema. So for this project, we were interested in three classes of antihypertensive medications that all target the same system in our body. And while doing that, we're hoping that we can build some general strategies to perform signal refinement for products that have been on the market for a while. And Greg mentioned this a minute ago. So in mini-sentinel, we used the term signal refinement to represent a set of activities that we do to further investigate some suspected safety signals. And in this pilot, we tend to differentiate between medical products that have been approved for a while and products that are newly approved. Because for older products, we usually have enough post-market data to do a one-time assessment using the data we have at the time of the analysis. And the angioedema project is considered this type of activity. On the other hand, for newly approved medical products, sometimes we don't have that much data soon after the products are approved, but we still want to get safety information as quickly as possible. So we might be using some sort of sequential methods to analyze the data as they accrue. So the methods that we are using for older and newer products might be different. So that's why we are making this distinction in mini-sentinel. And as Greg mentioned, this project was not designed to provide definitive evidence of a causal link.
You are being placed into conference in muted mode. This conference is being recorded.
Sorry, if I could just remind everybody to put your line on mute with the mute button or dialing *6, I'd appreciate it. Go ahead, Darren.
No, thank you. So with that, with those overarching goals in mind, let's talk about the project itself. So the drugs that we are interested in this project all target what we call the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system or RAAS system. So this is the system in our body that regulates our blood pressure. So by targeting different parts of this system, certain drugs are able to lower or control our blood pressure. So the first drug class that we are interested in was the ACE inhibitors, and the second class was the angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. And the third class is a relatively new drug class, the direct renin inhibitors. Right now in the United States, there's only one product approved under this category, and is L-scarin, and we include that drug in our analysis. So overall, we say that these drugs are more or less quite effective in managing our blood pressure, but some of them have been linked to a number of adverse events. The one that we are interested in this project was their risk with angioedema. So angioedema is a condition characterized by rapid localized swelling of the eyes, lip, tongue, mouth, upper respiratory tract, intestines, and so on. It can be potentially life-threatening because it can block the air passage. So the association between ACE inhibitors and angioedema is pretty well understood. Generally, it's believed that ACE inhibitors interfere with the degradation of bradykinin, and bradykinin plays a pretty significant role in the incidence of angioedema. So that's the underlying biological mechanism. So it is reasonable to also want to see whether drugs that are similar to ACE inhibitors, like ARBs or L-scarin, might also be associated with an increased risk of angioedema. So that's one of the reasons that we wanted to do these assessments, as Marsha mentioned. But before we did our analysis, there have been some population-based post-market studies done to try to quantify these associations. So I'm listing here a very well-done study done by Miller and colleagues using data from the Veteran Affairs population. So in this predominantly male population, Miller and colleagues found that the incidence rate of angioedema per 1,000 person years was about 2 for those who use ACE inhibitors. And as you can see from this slide, this risk is 3 to 4 times the risk for other antihypertensive medications. And for ARBs, the incidence rate per 1,000 person year was about 1, lower than ACE inhibitors, but appear to be higher than other antihypertensive medications. So that study didn't look at L-scarin because it was approved after the study was done. But there were some pooled analysis of randomized trials that show that the risk of angioedema and urticaria as a combined outcome for L-scarin appeared to be similar to or lower than ACE inhibitors and ARBs. But other than that, very little was known about the potential relation between L-scarin and angioedema. So the question that we were interested in was actually pretty straightforward, like Marsha and Greg mentioned previously. We wanted to know whether ACE inhibitors, ARB, and L-scarin are associated with a similar risk of angioedema. So we tried to answer this question in two ways. We first calculated the absolute risk of angioedema for each of these drug classes. And then we also tried to get some sort of relative measure of risk. So to do that, we introduced a common reference group against which each of these three drug classes will be compared. And our common reference group is the beta blockers. We chose beta blockers because they were also used as antihypertensive medications, but they are not thought to be associated with either higher or lower risk of angioedema. So we thought that that would be a reasonable reference group for us to get some sort of baseline risk of angioedema. And in this project, we also look at the risk associated with individual ARBs, but in the interest of time, I won't go over the results, but they can be found in an article that was published in the Archive of Internal Medicine yesterday, and they are also going to be reported in the final report that we are going to post very soon on the Mini Sentinel website. So let's talk about methods. So for this assessment, we used data from all the data partners that contributed data at the time of our assessment, which happened sometime in early 2011. So the data partners included HealthCourt, Tennessee Medicaid through the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, the HMO Research Network, Humana, Kaiser Permanente, and Aetna. Together, these data partners gave it access to more than 90 million individuals at the time of our analysis. So Optum is a new data partner in Mini Sentinel. Their data were not included in this angioedema assessment because they participated after the analysis was completed. So we included all the drugs that were on the market at the time of assessment. I'm just showing you that what these drugs are here. So for this assessment, we used an inception cohort design. In doing that, we identified individuals who are at least 18 years of age with the first dispensing of an oral formulation of any of the study drugs between 2001 and 2010. And for the purposes of the assessment, we define the index date as the dispensing date of the first dispensing of a study drug. And to be eligible for the analysis, we require patients to have at least 6 months of continuous enrollment with pharmacy and medical benefits prior to the index date. We imposed this requirement because we wanted to use this baseline period to exclude any users of other study drugs and to exclude any prior diagnosis of angioedema, and to use this period to identify potential confounders that we will adjust for in our analysis. And finally, we excluded patients who initiated more than one study drug on the index date. The primary outcome of interest was angioedema. We identified it through an ICD-9 code of 995.1 recorded in any position during an outpatient, inpatient, or emergency department visit. Prior studies have shown that this algorithm has a pretty good positive predictor value that ranges from 90 to 95%. And for this project, we also looked at a secondary outcome defined as serious angioedema. These are angioedema events that lead to airway obstruction and lead to inpatient care. And we also developed an algorithm to identify potential serious angioedema event. But again, I won't go over the results. They can be found in the paper and the report. So we started following patients for incidence of angioedema at the time they initiated their treatment, and then we followed them for as long as possible, and the censoring events are the end of the study period, or death, or helping disenrollment, or stopping of the initiated medication, or starting of another medication, or after 365 days of follow-up. So prior study has shown that the risk associated with ACE inhibitors, which is the association we know the most, the risk emerged pretty quickly, usually within the first few days, weeks, or months of use. So we thought that a one-year follow-up period seemed reasonable. We identify a list of potential confounders during the baseline window. So the confounders include age, sex, prior diagnosis of allergy reactions, diabetes, heart failure, ischemic heart disease, and prior use of NSAID. You can see that the list of confounders was not too long because the risk factors for angioedema are not as well understood as other outcomes like acute myocardial infarction, for example. And these confounders were identified based on our subject matter knowledge and based on a review of prior literature. So we first compare the baseline characteristics of each of the three cohorts of interest with beta blocker users, and then we calculated the unadjusted incidence rate of angioedema by drug class. And then we did three pairwise comparisons using beta blocker as the common reference group. And within each comparison, we did a site-adjusted analysis as well as a propensity score-adjusted analysis to get a hazard ratio and the 95% confidence intervals. So the propensity scores were the probability of initiating a beta blocker, and the probability was estimated within each site using a model that was common across all the data partners. So the model included all the potential confounders that you just saw as predictors for beta blocker initiation. So all the analysis was first done at each site, and then we need to come up with a way to combine the result across sites. So there were multiple ways that you could do that. We used methods that didn't require sharing of individual level information. So our primary analysis used what we call the K-center logistic regression approach. So this method was developed by Fireman and his colleagues, and I'm listing a reference here. The paper shows that if you structure your data into a risk set format, which is an aggregate data format, and fit your model in a certain way, you'll be able to get results that are identical to the results that you will obtain from a Cox model fit with individual level information. But the good thing is that you don't need individual level information to get the result you want. So it's actually a very appealing feature for us because we are operating in a distributed data system and we wanted to minimize transferring of individual level information. So just very briefly, a reset is created whenever a case occurs, and the reset is comprised of individuals who are at risk of the outcome at the time that the case occurs. So that is the method that we use as our primary analysis. And as secondary analysis, we did a meta-analysis. So in that secondary analysis, we thought of each analysis done at each site as a quote-unquote study, and then we use a meta-analytical approach to combine the site-specific hazard ratio and then get a pooled estimate. So there are various reasons for us to do this secondary analysis. The first is to see how robust our results are, and the second is to see the performances of different methods, because if you recall, another goal of this project is to build some sort of general strategies that we can use for future medical product assessment. So we wanted to know how good or how bad each method will perform in practice. Whenever possible, we did stratified analysis by age group, by sex, and by follow-up period. The analysis by follow-up period was of particular interest because prior study have shown that the risk for angioedema with ACE inhibitors changes over time, so the risk appeared to be the greatest immediately following treatment initiation and seemed to diminish over time. So we wanted to try to characterize the association by follow-up time, or equivalently by the time since treatment initiation. And we also performed a series of sensitivity analysis to see how our results might change based on different analytic scenarios. So instead of using a six-month window, we use a one-year look-back period to exclude prior uses, to exclude prior angioedema event. And we also did an analysis that excluded outpatient diagnosis of angioedema, even though prior validation studies show that outpatient diagnosis also seemed to be pretty accurate. And finally, we did an analysis that restricted to data obtained after approval of L scaling, which occurred in March 2007. As Marsha mentioned, this drug approved in different times, so we wanted to sort of account for potential temporal changes. So we did this secondary analysis so that we can get a more contemporaneous cohort across our analysis. So we use a distributed approach to do all the analysis. So this is just a graphical presentation of what Marsha just said. So very briefly, the project team developed and tested the program and then sent it to the operation center, who upload the program along with the documentation to the Mini Sentinel Secure Portal. Data partners were notified whenever there is a program to run. They review the code and the documentation, ran it against their local data set, and review the output, and then upload it back to the secure portal. And Mini Sentinel Operations Center collect all the outputs from all the data partners and then send them back to the project team to complete the analysis. And it sounds like a lot of steps, but we were able to do it in a pretty efficient way. So I'm going to talk about results now. We started with just over 65 million individuals who are at least 18 years of age. And after all the inclusion and exclusion criteria, we ended up with just over 3.9 million new users of study drugs. Overall, we have about 1.8 million ACE inhibitor users and about 470,000 ARB users, just under 5,000 L-scaring users, and about 1.6 million beta blocker users. So this slide shows you the distributions of the potential confounders by cohort. And we use a measure called standardized difference to compare each of the three cohort of interest with beta blocker users. And standardized difference is less sensitive to large sample size, and usually a value of 0.1 or greater would indicate a meaningful difference. So you can see that there are some differences, but these are all just the four in our analysis. So here are the crude incidences and incidence rates of angioedema by drug class. Overall, we identify more than 4,500 angioedema events, and the majority of them were among ACE inhibitor users. And if we use incidence rates as our risk measure, you can see that the risk appeared to be greater among those who use ACE inhibitors compared to beta blocker users. And the risk also appeared to be higher for those who use L-scarin, but the number is based only on 7 exposed cases among L-scan users, so we need to be careful in interpreting the results for L-scan users. On the other hand, ARB users and beta blocker users appear to have similar risk of angioedema. But these are all crude estimates without any adjustment. So here are the adjusted results. So I'm showing you the site-adjusted and propensity-score-adjusted hazard ratios. So you can see that additional adjustment for more potential confounders change the results a little bit, but not by too much. Overall, after adjustment, ACE inhibitors associated with a threefold higher risk of angioedema compared with beta blockers. And the hazard ratio was also about 3 for L-scarin, and the confidence interval excludes 1, but again, as you recall, these results are based only on 7 exposed cases for L-scarin users. On the other hand, the hazard ratio is 1.16 for ARPs, and the lower bound of the 95% confidence interval was 1. So how about the two methods that we use? We use the case-centered approach to get a primary result, and then we also did a meta-analysis. So this shows you how similar or different they are. So if you look at the propensity score adjusted analysis, you can see that the results are actually quite comparable, even though different granularity of information was being shared with these different approaches. So this actually was an indication to show that our results are actually quite robust under different analytic methods. So this figure shows you the analysis by age group for age inhibitors. So you can see that an increased risk was observed across all the age groups, and it seemed to be greater for those who are 65 years or older, but again, the hazard ratio were above 1 across age group, all the age groups. And similarly, we also found that the results are quite consistent across age groups, although for ARPs, you can see that the 95% confidence intervals are wider because we have fewer cases associated with ARP use. So here are the results by sex. The association between ACE inhibitors and angioedema was observed among both male and female users. It appears that the risk might be slightly greater for female users. And for ARPs, the results are also quite consistent by sex. Again, overlapping 95% confidence intervals, but the hazard ratios are all on the same side. And we weren't able to do any stratified analysis for L-scaring because we only had 7 exposed cases, so we weren't able to do any additional stratification. So here are the results by follow-up period. So this might be the most interesting one. So let's look at ACE inhibitor first. You can see that the risk, the hazard ratio, was the greatest during the first 30 days following treatment initiation. And the hazard ratio has a very narrow 95% confidence intervals, which indicates that many cases occur during this period. So after the first 30 days, you can see that the hazard ratio diminished a little bit, but was still greater compared to beta blocker use. The trend is less clear for ARPs, but you can also sort of see that the risk might be the greatest during the first 30 days of use with a pretty narrow 95% confidence intervals that excludes 1. And finally, for the sensitivity analysis, when we use a 1-year look-back period, you can see that the incidence rates are pretty similar, except maybe for L-scaring, but I would attribute this to random variation because we started with 7 exposed cases. With this more stringent criterion, we had fewer cases. And overall, the hazard ratios are also quite comparable. Again, some minor variation for L-scaring use. So when we excluded outpatient diagnosis, as expected, the incidence rate was lower. But hazard ratios are overall quite comparable. You might notice that the hazard ratio appeared to be increased a little bit after we excluded outpatient diagnosis. There might be a number of reasons for that. It could mean that ACE inhibitors might be associated with a more severe angioedema event that lead to emergency department or inpatient care. But it could also mean that physicians and patients are more mindful about these potential side effects. So physicians might tell patients to go to ER whenever they have any signs or symptoms for angioedema. So there are various explanations for this potential change in hazard ratio. And of course, it could also be due to random variation. So finally, with a more contemporaneous cohort, the incidence rates are very similar so are the hazard ratios across the three drug classes. So to summarize, we were able to replicate a non-association between ACE inhibitors and angioedema, but we were able to do that with a much more precise risk estimate because of the large sample size that we had. For L-scaring, we were able to provide new information about the potential association between L-scaring and angioedema. But again, our numbers are based on a relatively small number of cases, so obviously there needs to be more investigation to better quantify this potential association. And finally, for ARBs, we found that there might be a slightly elevated risk of angioedema, and the magnitude in the increased risk is much lower than the one that we observe for ACE inhibitors and L-scaring. And the results are marginally statistically significant. So, again, if there are more research to better quantify this, that would be great. There are a number of limitations to our analysis. I'm highlighting the most significant one, which is our inability to adjust for race. So prior studies have shown that race is a probable confounder for the ACE inhibitors and angioedema relation. And it could also be an effect modifier. Some studies have shown that African-American race, African-Americans might have a higher risk of ACE inhibitor-induced angioedema. But right now, immunosensional, we don't yet have complete race information for us to do meaningful adjustments, so we didn't do any of them. But we did a series of sensitivity analysis, and under the all the likely scenarios that we imagine, our inability to adjust for race would likely lead to an underestimation of the true relative risk. And there are a number of strengths as well. First is our large sample size, which allowed us to do some analysis that would otherwise not be possible, such as the L-scaling analysis, then the analysis by individual ARP that we didn't have time to go over today. And another strength is the diverse populations that we have, which increases the generalizability of our findings. And another strength is the robustness of our results under different analytic scenarios. So this is my last slide. So Marsha mentioned this. So we are able to do this in a pretty efficient way, both in terms of time and resource. So the project started in early 2011, so we are able to develop a protocol that is also available online on the MiniSentinel website. And we were able to develop the analytic program and write a report all within a one-year time frame. But this is somehow truncated timeline because I didn't include the one-and-a-half-year period that we spent trying to stand up the data infrastructure and trying to bring together investigators to work on the MiniSentinel program. But now we are at a point where these infrastructures is in place for us to do an assessment like this in a very efficient way. So this is a project that we recently completed, and there are a number of projects that are near completion, and a number of projects are starting up. So hopefully we'll be able to share more of the results from these medical product assessments with you in the near future. So that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Darren, and thank you, Marsha, for your presentations. I'm going to go ahead and go to the lines for questions. We've had a couple questions submitted through the Q&A tab. Again, if anybody does have questions that they'd like to submit, go ahead and do that through the Q&A tab on your screen. And as those start accumulating, we'll go to each of you to ask your questions. But before we do that, I'd like to ask just a couple of questions, and I do know that Marsha needed to drop off. So, Darren, you're on the hook for these questions. What I'd like to ask you about, I think one of the most novel things about this analysis was the way that you guys were able to compare the analysis based on the risk set data, which was a way for you to develop your hazard ratio estimates using the entire distributed database. Can you speak a little bit more about the strengths and limitations of that method as compared to developing the individual hazard ratios at each of the sites?
Oh, sure. So one strength that I can think of is like we don't need to share individual level information to do robust confounding adjustment. I think that this is really a strength of this method, and we are also using this method in our ongoing AMI surveillance of anti-diabetic agents. So I think that that's definitely a strength. In terms of potential limitations, I don't want to get too technical, but sometimes it'll be hard to create a risk set within each site if the sample size is too small. So when that happens, we might need to do some adjustment. For example, ideally, we would create a risk set whenever the case occurs. In the database that we have, we can do it on a daily basis. So on the day that a case is identified, we look at the data and create a reset on that day. But if the sample size is too small, we might not be able to do that on a daily basis. So we might need to expand it on the to weekly or monthly or even quarterly. So that is a potential limitation. But there might be ways for us to get around that. A possibility is to try to see if we can borrow information from other sites. This might get easier if we are using something like disease risk score, because different people with the same disease risk score, even though they are in different sites, they might be comparable. This is not true for propensity scores. So we might be able to identify some ways to get around this. So hopefully that answered your question.
Yes, it did. That's great. Thank you for that. So I will go to the queue of questions. I'll call on your name. For those who submitted a question, go ahead and unmute your line or press *7 so that we can hear you read your question. So the first person I'll go to is Kent Johnson. Kent, are you on the line? And go ahead and read your question, please. Okay, Kent. Again, *7 to unmute if you're able to do that. Okay, I'll go ahead and read the question. So, Darren, this is to you. So, Kent asked, "Have you done any simulated sensitivity analyses that altered the propensity score by varying amounts in order to see what the effect would be on the resulting hazard ratio?"
That's a good question. We didn't. So we use a common propensity score model because that is more efficient and because the list of confounders it was not too long. So there are various ways for us to try to fit a propensity score model in the distributed setting like this. An alternative approach would be to let each site fit its own propensity score model so that we are not limited to what I call a common denominator approach. So what we are doing in our project is that the confounders can all be identified in all data partner sites, and the model was common across all sites. So that is just one of the many approaches that one could consider. So a way to see how each of these approaches perform would be to do some sort of simulation studies, but in this project we didn't do that.
Okay, great. Thanks, Darren. So the next question came in from Tatiana Shyamalan. Tatiana, go ahead and press star 7 to unmute and ask your question. Okay, I'll go ahead and read that question as well. Tatiana's question is around drug-drug interactions, and I know it's often challenging to assess those using the claims data, but Darren, can you speak a little bit about whether you were able to examine drug-drug interactions or how that might have factored into the results?
So that's, again, a good question. So Greg, you're right. It might be a little bit challenging to do that in administrative health plan data, but there are ways to do that. We didn't do it the goal is to do some rapid medical product assessment, and we are not trying to draw any causal inference. So that's why we use a more or less a streamlined protocol. So we thought about drug-drug interaction, but we didn't do it. But at least for the drugs that we looked at, the four drug classes that we looked at, there will be no scenarios in which patient use more than one of these medications. So at least we can remove that possibility. But again, we didn't look at all antihypertensive medication, for example, so it is possible that a patient might be using a beta blocker with a calcium channel blocker or ACE inhibitor with a calcium channel blocker. We didn't account for that in our analysis. But for all the four drug classes, patient can only use one of them in our analysis.
Okay, great. So the next question came in from John Rickman. John, if you're on the line, go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, I'm on the line, but I think since Marcia is no longer there, I might ask a new question.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Just wondering if what the next study might be for Mini Sentinel, the next assessment.
So there are numbers that are currently ongoing. I am hesitant a little bit because I don't know which one is public and which one is not public. For those that have a protocol, you can find them on the Mini Sentinel public website. So we post every protocol that is associated with a medical product assessment. So the ones that are currently there are definitely public. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to share with you more information. But as soon as a protocol is ready, they will all be posted on the public website before any analysis is done.
If I could ask a follow-up.
Sure.
Well, just want to get your take on this particular assessment and to what extent you think the Sentinel approach benefits betters previous assessments, because it sounds like it just, like you say, replicated known associations with ACIs. You got a new drug and you got some new information. That's good. But then the IRBs didn't seem, the ARBs didn't seem to, that information didn't seem to be, doesn't sound to me like it's all that new either. What does Sentinel provide, that, at least on this assessment, that's better than before?
Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily better than others because every study has its own strengths and limitations. For this particular assessment, we were able to provide data for individual ARBs. So I didn't present those results here today, but they can be found in the paper and the report. So at least for that, I would say that because of the large sample size that we have, we are able to do that. So if we were just using one of the databases, we probably won't have enough sample size to do robust analysis with this individual ARP analysis. So I think that is a strength. And again, for L-scan, we were able to provide new information. And another strength that I would say is the diversity of our cohort, which increases the generalizability.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, could I also add that for the individual ARBs, there were some questions about differences in where the warnings were in the labels, and these results at least suggest, because of low numbers, that there didn't need to be any labeling changes.
So great. Marcia, that was you, I believe, right? I think I told everybody that you had dialed off, so if you're...
Yeah, I was able to stay on with the phone, although not with the video.
So no labeling changes needed?
Where there were differences in where things were placed in the label, it was felt that didn't need to be changed based on these results.
Okay.
Okay, great. Next person that had a question is Ken Hornbuckle. Ken, are you on the line? If so, go ahead and ask your question.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. Very good. We actually had two questions. You had mentioned in your message about cessation of therapy. The first question is, can you clarify how you define cessation of therapy? And then the second question, I think you alluded to that in the previous question, was more around how would the results from this study be used for regulatory decision-making?
So I will be able to answer the first one. Maybe the second question will be answered by Marcia. To identify stopping of medication, we use the day supply information in our pharmacy table. So we know that when the medication is dispensed and the day supply for that dispensing, so we are able to sort of estimate when the end date will be. And then we extended it for 14 days to accommodate possible non-adherence. So this is not special to our analysis. Many pharmacotherapeutic assessments do that. So we extended the dispensing period by 14 days after the end of the last dispensing.
Yeah, I just wanted that clarification. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second part?
To answer the other question that you asked, the data from MiniSentinel is one data stream that's used along with other data streams that are available, including both spontaneous reports through AIRS, information that comes from sponsors, complete epidemiologic studies, and each of these is weighted with the rigor of the information for a particular drug safety issue. So the extent to which one data source would be dominant would really depend on what the particular issue is.
Okay, great. Ken, do you have a follow-up?
Oh, no. Just thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So we do have one more question that came into the queue, and that came from James Miller. James, if you can, go ahead and read your question, please. Okay.
Hello?
James?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead and read your question.
Okay. With this analysis, was there any attempt to make a comparative analysis of how successful these different drugs were in the treating of the primary condition that they were prescribed for? Or was there even an attempt to identify the different conditions different conditions these drugs would be prescribed for, and do an analysis of that?
The short answer is no. So I think that the question that you describe is more of a comparative effectiveness question. So for this particular project, the scope is more on comparative safety, and it's very specific to just one of several adverse events that one can look at. So we didn't look at that, and we could try to do a stratified analysis by indication to see whether patients who use this medication for different indication might have different rates of angioedema. We didn't do that. And one challenge of doing that is that it's sometimes very hard to identify indication, at least in the current data system that we are using. There might be a way, but we didn't do that.
And if I could follow up, I guess the reason I asked that question is I could see it, the overall arching assumption in the study is that each one of these drugs are used to treat the same problem. But if that's not the case, that really sort of negates the whole question.
Yeah, that's a good point. So so that's why when I try to present it, I say that they are all targeting the same system. I'm like the RAS system. I'm not trying to draw any conclusion based on different indications for which these drugs are used. I use the term antihypertensive medications because they are approved as an antihypertensive medication, even though some of them might be used for other indications.
Okay, great. Well, I'd like to go ahead and thank Marcia and Darren for their presentations. I'd also like to thank everyone who was able to dial in and watch these webinars. As usual, the presentation materials, including the audio for this session, will be posted on the Brookings website within the next few days. And then I'd also like to let everybody know about our next roundtable webinar, which will be held on December 7th, and the topic will be one of MiniSentinel's other projects titled Developing a Taxonomy of Surveillance Methods for Medical Product Safety. So we're looking forward to that presentation. And we will be sending out an announcement for that in the coming week, so please keep an eye out for that. So thanks again for participating this afternoon, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.